Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 78. And I'm coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland tonight, and I'm talking with Armon Cohen, who is the executive director of the Boston-based Clean Air Task Force, which is a national advocacy group devoted to reducing emissions of pollutants and greenhouse gases. So we have a lot in common.
Certainly some overlapping interests, for sure.
Yeah, we definitely have a lot of overlapping interests with regard to your efforts to work on the damage that's caused by the emissions, air emissions from coal-fired power plants, and also the danger that may be posed by storage of coal combustion waste, CCW.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, Rod, are we live now? Or
Yes, we are live.
Okay, great. Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, our organization certainly has been involved for about 11 years on these topics, and there's no question that coal-fired energy is the cause of a number of environmental problems, all the way from air emissions to solid waste, as you mentioned. Water quality, and our organization has been primarily devoted to working on cleaning up existing coal-fired plants and also trying to divert new coal build around the world to much cleaner technologies like gasification with carbon sequestration.
Okay, and I assume that you also have some concerns about things like flattening of West Virginia and a few other effects of coal combustion.
Yeah, I mean, I think we certainly have worked with organizations that are focused on the land use issues. I think the thing I want to make clear is that my organization is not an anti-coal organization, our view is that coal is most likely something that's going to be necessary as part of the energy mix for quite some time. We don't oppose the construction of new coal power plants per se. We do believe that there are technologies to eliminate the vast majority of the impacts of coal-fired energy through a variety of media. I mentioned gasification as a way of dealing with the conventional pollutants and reducing the solid wastes and rendering them in a form which is significantly less damaging than current coal combustion byproducts. There's certainly ways to deal with a variety of the other pollutants. With respect to CO2, our view is that coal is a problematic fuel, but again, because it is likely to be with us for some time, both the existing fleet of coal-fired power plants and the new coal build, particularly in places like India and China, it's quite important to do it as in a way that's going to have as little impact on the atmosphere as possible. And right now, the best pathway forward for that seems to be pre-combustion capture of carbon and carbon sequestration.
Now, you mentioned that those technologies are available. Can you tell me what the status of those technologies is today?
Well, with respect to carbon capture, we're doing it, actually. Post-combustion capture we're doing in a variety of industrial settings. We aren't doing it with power at the moment, but there are a number of chemical facilities and other industrial sites around the world where we're capturing carbon dioxide, mainly for use in commercial applications like the use of enhanced oil recovery, for example, in the Western United States. With respect to the core gasification technology, coal gasification, that is a well-understood technology, and it is deployed. There are four coal gasification plants for electric power in the world. There are two in the United States and two in the European Union. This is technology that's been around for quite a while. So there's nothing exotic about those technologies. What we haven't done quite yet in any specific application is to marry the two up, to have coal gasification and synthetic gas production from coal and marry it up directly to carbon capture and storage. Mm-hmm. But that is not rocket science. That's a matter of just doing it. And as you may know, there are several proposals around the world to begin to do that, to marry those two technologies up. There was the FutureGen proposal in the United States. There's actually a proposal that's moving forward, or an actual project that's moving forward in Indiana right now called the Edwardsport IGCC, or Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle Plant, which we've advocated and the company is considering, in that case, doing a demonstration scale removal of carbon at a 20% level initially.
Well, let me ask you,
this is not pre-commercial technology. This is technology that's already in commercial use.
Well, is it in commercial cost-effective uses? As I understand both of the coal gasification combined cycle plants operating in the U.S. are pilot scale plants that were supported with fairly significant grants from the Department of Energy.
It's a fair point that the two plants in the United States did receive subsidies initially from the federal government. And right now, the best guess is that to build a new IGCC plant in the United States, there might be something like a 20% cost premium over a conventional coal combustion plant. So, you know, it's a question of what you define as cost effective. Some might argue that the cost premium for an IGCC over a conventional coal plant is likely to be prudent in light of the potential to avoid CO2 through carbon capture at a later time, as well as a significant reduction in conventional pollutants. But people argue it the other way as well. I think the thing to observe about nuclear and IGCC with carbon capture and a variety of other technologies is, you know, at least this is our perspective on the topic, is that you can argue back and forth about the pennies per kilowatt hour here and there, but the uncertainties are actually so large, I think, in all of these technologies, not so much technological uncertainty, but price uncertainty associated with fuel source costs, the cost of construction, the costs in the case of nuclear of interruptions due to various technical problems. In the case of coal, IGCC, reliability issues, or as well as the price of coal and the price of steel. I think one way of thinking about this is that I think the MIT Future of Coal report, as well as their report on the future of nuclear power, makes this point, I think, quite well, is that most of these technologies are pretty much within striking range of each other cost-wise. So the question of what's cost-effective, you know, to some extent in the eye of the beholder, but it's also true that there aren't 3 or 4 cent per kilowatt-hour differences in the costs of these various alternatives. They're mostly within the 1 to 2, 2.5 cents per kilowatt-hour range, which I would argue are ranges that, are not quite noise, but pretty close to it when you really think about the variety of other price factors that might influence alternatives over, say, the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, so. I've done some cost analysis of all the options, and I have to laugh every time I see somebody do a cost analysis that takes it down to the second or third decimal point, because there's so many uncertainties, as you say, in all of the technologies, and the assumptions that one makes with regard to capacity factor and interest rates and steel costs and labor costs and location and transportation of fuel costs. And I mean, there's all kinds of things, and I really believe that a plus or minus 4% window for a single type of technology is not unreasonable, depending on where you put it and who's building it.
No, I would agree, and I think that I think we do our best to make these judgments, but I think the interesting thing about the present moment of concern about climate change is that it's pretty clear we're going to have to mobilize a massive amount of technology if we really have a serious hope of solving this problem. You know, people debate where, you know, does IGCC fit into that? Does nuclear fit into that? But there's no question that there's that everything's going to cost money, and it's not there, other than energy efficiency, arguably, there aren't a lot of free rides out there. So I think we're probably better off focusing on issues like feasibility, timeframes, and acceptability rather than cost. Because I think that if there's anything that's been proven, it's that everyone's cost estimates are going to be wrong, and sometimes by a factor as much as two.
Yes.
Probably important to get the core issue sorted out, which does it pass the threshold of acceptability environmentally, and does it meet the reliability standards that we need, and then as I say, the rest is not exactly noise, but it's certainly second order issues.
Right. Going back to the carbon capture discussion, I know that there are some industrial plants that are capturing carbon, but the scale of those operations appear to be quite small compared to the scale of a single coal-fired power plant.
That's absolutely right. Typically, a typical coal-fired power plant is going to put out somewhere in the, say, a 1,000-megawatt coal-fired power plant is likely to put out something in the, I believe, the range of 4 to 6 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. The typical industrial applications are, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of tons a year. There are a couple pilot projects around the world right now, for example, the Statoil project, Sleipner project in the North Sea, which is injecting about a million tons of CO2. A year into the ground, into the seabed. There are several other projects that are proposed to be at that scale. I believe that the Algerian project in Salah, being conducted by BP, is also in the million ton per year range. So, it's not out of scale with power plant level production, but you're correct. We haven't done it at that scale. I will say that I think it is a fair point, and you don't have to listen to me on this. You can just turn to the IPCC's report on carbon capture and sequestration. I think it's fair to say that the consensus of the engineers and scientists who work in this area is that the scale-up issues are really not issues of step change kinds of challenges. They're really just issues of managing the amounts of material, which, again, there don't seem to be any showstoppers there. And at least that's the IPCC view. And we certainly will need to do several 1 million ton per year scale sequestration projects before we're ready to say, this is absolutely the way to go on a very large scale. But that may be able to be accomplished in the next 5 to 7 years if we're smart about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, after we build these sequestration projects, how long do you think we need to monitor them to make sure that the carbon's staying where we put it?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are different schools of thought on that. There is a view that we need to be thinking about 1,000-year kind of level monitoring, which of course is kind of an imponderable if you think about the scale on which governments last. There is another view of the world, which is that given the present you might argue crisis nature of the climate issue, what we need to do is find something that can be monitored and reliable for a couple hundred years, on the theory at least that what we're looking for is a bridge technology that can get us to the point where even if there is leakage over time, we can deal with it through other technological means. So there is a view that says this stuff doesn't have to be airtight forever. In fact, I think the geological consensus out there, again, as expressed, say, through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on this topic, is that the amount of storage that's available certainly is adequate to the scale we're talking about for worldwide power production of CO2, and that with respect to reliability of it staying in place once it's there, I believe that the IPCC report concluded that there was a extremely high likelihood that that material would be present for hundreds of years, and a high likelihood, like in the 99% plus range, that it would be in situ for 1,000 years. But the question of how certain do we have to be is really an interesting one. I think if you step back on the climate issue generally, you'd probably have to conclude that we don't necessarily need permanent solutions. We really need solutions that can get us over this huge, or avoid this huge lump of carbon that looks like it's about to be put into the atmosphere over the next 50 years, especially given the growth rate of the developing economies of India and China. And, again, we might be able to deal with leakage problems, 100 years down the road.
Okay.
But incidentally, there are arguments made, not unlike arguments made on the nuclear side, that maybe the best way to deal with the nuclear waste for now is on-site storage, or maybe centralized above-ground storage. And at a later time, as technology moves forward, we might be able to come up with a permanent solution. So that there's actually some symmetry of argument in the two areas.
Yeah, well, let me, I got to express a little bit of my frustration, because the comments that you made about, well, it's a kind of an okay thing, and we can do it and fix it later if we don't get it quite right the first time, and the scale of storing. Let's see, we burn 1.3 billion tons of coal a year, and for every ton of coal, you produce 3.5 tons of carbon dioxide. And the people who kind of slough off, well, we can just figure out how to store that. And then the same people complain vociferously about 70,000 tons of solid corrosion-resistant oxide fuel that still has 95% of its potential energy, and it's been produced over 50 years of operating nuclear power plants. So I don't understand those people who have that view that nuclear waste is unsolvable, but carbon sequestration, well, that's almost a done deal already.
Yeah, I'm not sure you're characterizing the position accurately, that people who are advocating carbon sequestration are sloughing off the risks. I think the number of us who are in that area are actually quite concerned that the technology be demonstrated over the next several years. But I take your point, which is that there are comparative risks here. There are no absolutely safe alternatives. And I think where it would be much more interesting to see the public policy discussion go at this point, rather than in absolutes, is to be comparing these risks, say the risks associated with nuclear waste and the risks associated with carbon storage and carbon leakage. I think your point's legitimate that those risks really need to be put head-to-head rather than being a conversation stopper that, you know, says, well, we can't do nuclear because of the waste problem. I think it's fair to say that the waste problem from the coal side is also what we're putting into the atmosphere. I have to say that, unfortunately, I don't think the public policy debate has been able to focus on that comparative risk equation in a very intelligent way. I think probably most thoughtful people on all sides of the nuclear question would agree on that.
Yeah, it's one of the other things that comes to my mind is a lot of folks involved in a discussion don't necessarily open up as to why they advocate for what they do. For example, many of the folks that are pressing very hard and supporting activities like the activity against TXU in Texas didn't make it quite clear that what they really want to do was sell natural gas.
I'm not sure, Rod, that that's necessarily the case for all the people who were opposed to the...
I didn't say all the people. I said some of the people, but Chesapeake Energy was very active in that and was running a lot of advertisements, with the people with dirty faces and all that stuff. And, I know Chesapeake Energy very well. I like Chesapeake Energy. They've been a very good investment for me. But anyway, you know,
I think very often there are many parties come to positions for various reasons. I think that's a fair point.
Right. I mean, I did come across a presentation done with Heller Ehrman and you. I'm not sure exactly what the date was, but your partner in creating the presentation has a firm that works with advanced coal gasification technology companies, both surface gasification and underground coal gasification. So at least on his side, he has some interest in advocating for coal gasification.
Fair enough, but isn't that true for advocates of any technology? I mean, when the Nuclear Energy Institute makes an argument for nuclear power, are they not to some degree financially, or their members are not financially interested in that?
Oh, I'm sure. Obviously, the Nuclear Energy Institute doesn't make any secrets of the fact that it is a nuclear industry advocacy group. I mean, that's what their goal is. They say they're about us, and that's, I mean, they're the industry representative. They don't make any secrets about it.
So, right. I don't think that the people you're referring to who are advocating on coal gasification in this case, I happen to know the individual, are making any secrets about the fact that they are representing coal gasification companies and developers. I think that was actually made quite explicit in the program that person appeared. So I don't think it necessarily disqualifies anyone to talk on an issue of public policy when they have a financial interest in it.
Well, I hope not, since I have a financial interest in nuclear and I want to be involved in the discussion. But I make that very clear to people. From a standpoint of someone who's very concerned about air quality and atmosphere, I guess I come to this from the point of view of having been a submarine engineer officer and always figuring that if it's clean enough to run inside a submarine, it should be something that's certainly on the table when you're worried about air pollution of any kind, not just climate-changing air pollution, but fly ash and mercury and sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides and all kinds of other nasties that come out of burning stuff. So one of the things I've tried to do over the years is try to talk to folks who have a very strong advocacy role about, you know, fighting air pollution and clean air. And some reason, every time I talk to them and say I want to do nuclear, many of them won't even talk to me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help me understand that?
Well, I think I really don't know who you talk to, so I can't say. I can only speak for my own organization, which is that we're looking at nuclear. We participated in a study conducted as part of a variety of stakeholders last year by the Keystone Institute, based in Washington, worked with the Nuclear Energy Institute, EPRI, and a variety of other parties to look at the issues as objectively as we could on nuclear. And my organization is officially neutral on nuclear. We haven't taken a position for or against it. It's a fair point that I think we need to be looking more closely at it. We certainly don't reject it out of hand as part of a variety of strategies we need, not just to address air quality, but climate. So I can only speak for myself and my organization saying we don't dismiss nuclear. We've been not only shown willingness to discuss it, but actually willingness to discuss it with a variety of other parties. And, in fact, I don't think anything can be taken off the table given the enormity of the climate challenge that we face. So
your organization's been around since, what, 96? Is that right?
Correct.
Has your position on nuclear been evolving since that time?
I would say that discussions have been evolving. Our position has always been officially neutral. You can only focus on so many things, and we've chosen to focus on cleaning up the coal sector. We actually didn't start primarily as an organization working on climate at all. We worked on an organization dealing with primarily the issue of cleaning up existing coal plants rather than advocating alternatives. I would say that as we're trying to get more educated on it, and I think our understanding is increasing, and I think that that it's fair to say that our understanding is evolving. I answer to a board of directors, so I'm sure at some point this will become an issue as to whether the organization needs to be engaged more proactively on the topic.
Now, your organization consists of about 20 people, is that right?
About 20 individuals, probably about 12 full-time equivalents.
Okay. And those are mostly lawyers and engineers and scientists?
Well, I'd say it's actually probably more focused on technically educated people. We have MBAs, engineers, scientists, some lawyers, some general polymaths, mostly people who have some expertise in the energy and air quality field.
Okay. And let's see. One of the things I found was a testimony that you did back in 2000 about the issue of the one of the things that you talked about was the issue of the grandfathered coal-fired power plants. Can you help my listeners understand what that issue is?
Right. The issue really is has to do with the question of what standards have to be met for emissions by coal-fired energy plants in the United States. And the essentially the argument is that when Congress created the initial Clean Air Act of 1970 and then with the amendments of 1977, the Congress allowed existing coal-fired power plants to continue their emissions at current levels, but required new coal-fired power plants to meet much more stringent levels. The one exception they carved out was an area called New Source Review, which simply said that in the case that there's a major modification of an existing coal-fired power plant to be defined, major modification to be defined,
big loophole.
The plant would have to meet a new source standard or a much more stringent standard. But essentially the decision at the time in the 1970s was predicated on the idea that the existing coal-fired power plants would likely retire over a period of a couple decades, and so this would be a problem that would eventually go away, and ultimately everything would be meeting the new, more stringent standards. In fact, due to the price of natural gas and a variety of other factors, much of that fleet is still chugging along, and these plants may have 50 or 60 year lives. So the term grandfathering really refers to the fact that existing coal-fired power plants that were built as of 1970 or 77 were exempted from the more stringent standards that a new coal-fired power plant built after that time would have to meet.
Yeah, I've actually gone back in the legislative history, and one of the things that's interesting is if you look at the projected electrical power grid from a 1970 point of view, using the best available information, what the equivalent of the Energy Information Agency said then was that by 2000, essentially all the coal-fired power plants would have been replaced by nuclear plants. And so that was part of the discussion during the legislative passing was, hey, these guys are going to be going away anyway, so we'll just, you know, let them not have to put in major investments.
I'm not familiar with that particular part of the legislative history, but it's certainly true that the prevailing assumption was that power plants that had been built in the 50s and early 60s were probably not going to have 40 to 50 year lives, but here we are in 2008 with many of those plants chugging along without much insight by way of retirement.
Yeah. Now, when you do, I'm going to jump back a little bit. When you do the integrated gasification combined cycle, and you do the gasification on the front end, where do the contaminants like mercury, selenium, uranium, and all that other stuff that's in the coal and normally comes out in fly ash and other pieces, where does it go?
Most of what happens to the solids in that process, and I will tell you that I am not an engineer, so what I'm going to say is not going to be highly technical, but I would refer you back to the Future of Coal report by MIT, which came out in April of 2007, I believe, or March of 2007. Most of the existing gasification technologies are compatible with various gas cleanup processes. Some of the solids precipitate out as part of the gas cleanup process post-combustion. My understanding is that if you apply things like a carbon bed filters, you end up with 99.9% mercury removal before the synthetic gas goes to the turbine. You end up with arsenic and selenium embedded in vitrified waste if you use a slagging gasifier technique, which is kind of the predominant technology out there right now. So you're not, you obviously don't, you're not vaporizing the contaminants, but you are embedding them in a much more stable vitrified form. That's about as technical as I can get with you this evening, but there is, you're not in a situation where you're actually putting those contaminants into the combustion chamber. What ends up going to the combustion chamber of the gas turbine is essentially a gas consisting of hydrogen, CO, and CO2, and that's your synthetic gas. So you are entraining the contaminants in an earlier stage.
Okay. And on the sequestration part, the storage part, I've read some reports. I think the IGCC report uses the same range. They talk about using 10 to 40% of the energy output of the plant for the process of compressing and cooling and injecting the carbon underground. Does that sound familiar to you?
That does not sound correct to me. The estimates associated with the energy or parasitic load associated with compression of carbon dioxide for storage typically been more in the 10 to 15% range. Some of the higher end estimates are about 20%. 40% is something would be more associated with a post-combustion capture. But I think your numbers are off there, and I would again urge you to consult the MIT Future of Coal report, right, which I think is accepted as pretty authoritative.
Right, the 10 to 40 may have included the post-combustion. I can't remember exactly where I read it.
Right, I think the IGCCs would arguably be much more at the lower end of that range. But there's no question that there's a parasitic load associated with the removal and compression of carbon dioxide.
I got my acronyms mixed up. That was the IPCC report about carbon sequestration,
right, which addressed more than just there's pre-combustion capture and post-combustion capture, and I think those are two very different animals, certainly from the standpoint of energy requirements.
Right. Now, if we were to do the carbon capture, and I know that there's plenty of volume in the earth to store the gas, the question is, are there only certain places where the geology is suitable for storage so that we would have to pipe the gas from a long distance from certain places?
There is enough knowledge to know at this point, and I again would refer your listeners to the IPCC Special Report on Carbon Capture and Storage, which I believe came out in late 2006, if I'm not mistaken. There's actually some very good maps in that report that show where the various candidate reservoirs are located. Just my rough memory of that is that a very significant portion of the planet's land surface contains or has such reservoirs subjacent. That said, there are gaps, and notable gaps, in fact, in places like the upper Midwest United States. So if one were to say, use a lignite IGCC in northern Minnesota, one would have to look at piping the removed and captured CO2 to the saline aquifers, let's say, that begin around southern Wisconsin. So, you know, you're talking about maybe several hundred miles worth of distance. So there's no question that unless you're going to just only locate plants over various formations, you will have to do some piping. That said, a significant part of the most populated parts of the world are sitting on top of these saline aquifers and abandoned gas mines, gas fields and oil fields. I would also point out that the economics of transporting CO2 even thousands of miles are not astronomical. The estimates that have come forward in a number of settings are typically that the transportation part of the CO2 equation is actually relatively small compared to the carbon capture and storage or the carbon capture part of the equation. So you're looking typically at fractions of a cent per kilowatt hour for the actual transportation part of the equation.
I'll be a little skeptical about that just based on the cost per mile of building pipelines, even that are carrying valuable products like natural gas. I have to go back and take a look at how they factor in the capitalization of building the pipeline initially. Plus the right-of-way concerns are, it's never easy to build a pipeline. So.
But it's also true that we have already thousands of miles of existing carbon dioxide gas pipelines in the United States. We're already transporting CO2 very long distances quite cost-effectively for enhanced oil recovery, particularly
right.
in the South and Southwest. So,
right, but that's in a place where there's a market for the carbon. You're not just transporting a waste product. So when you figure out the economics of building a pipeline just to transport the waste product, that may be a little different than the pipelines that already exist transporting a valuable product back to the oil fields. And in some cases, those pipelines were simply turned pipelines that already exist, turned them back, going the other way, carrying a different product.
That may be true, but it's also true that if we do get to the point where carbon dioxide costs generators to enter into the atmosphere, there is going to be an economic value associated with storing it. So you can sort of make that argument the other way. The point is that these are not costs that are off the charts, and it's certainly not a technically undoable feat. It's just a question of what's the price of carbon, and does it cost more to emit it and pay the price, or does it cost more to even transport it long distances to put it underground? That said, these are numbers that people will kick around, but I think that even assuming no price for carbon, one is talking that the issue you address of market value doesn't bear at all on the actual cost of building the plant. It only bears on the market value of doing so. So the fact that these pipelines were built in the Southwest doesn't mean they wouldn't cost in the range that are being estimated right now of fractions of a cent per kilowatt hour. I think those are two separate issues.
Yes, I agree with you. They're different issues, but I've had a lot of experience talking to engineers, and very rarely do engineers know much about economics, and they often vastly underestimate the cost of things like getting pipelines sited and that kind of stuff. So we'll agree to continue the discussion and realize that is going to be part of the discussion as time goes on. And the other thing that some people have pointed out to me is there's an incident that gets talked about a lot, particularly from nuclear advocates, where there's a lake down, I think in South America somewhere, that burped. It has a large amount of CO2 stored in a, not from human effort, but just CO2 that was stored for some reason. And it had a turnover, and when it burped, it produced an asphyxiating cloud that caused a fair number of deaths. And I could give you links or something to that. But Who is going to be liable if a reservoir doesn't do the storage that it's supposed to do?
Well, let's go back to your point. First of all, the event in question was in Cameroon, actually, in Africa, Lake Nyos. That is discussed in the IPCC report. That was a natural entrainment of CO2. There were peculiar circumstances there where the atmospheric pressure was unusual because the lake was located deep in a depressed valley, and there was a natural release of CO2, and it basically the CO2 cloud stayed very low and did kill quite a number of people. That's not that sort of huge catastrophic release is not the sort of scenario that is, I think, anyone has envisioned with subsurface storage in saline aquifers of carbon dioxide. That's the lake geology is an entirely different context, and I don't think is analogous to the kinds of storage reservoirs we're looking at for carbon. That said, the issue of liability is an important one. I think that the let's divide the topic into two parts. There's liability for releases that may have human health effects, and then there's liability of releases that for releases that simply have the effect of putting carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, therefore reducing the value of the storage to begin with from an environmental standpoint. Those are slightly different animals. But the question you pose is an interesting one, and I think that is being debated quite extensively right now. I would point your listeners to the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission's recent report on this topic. Came out in the fall of this year, which proposes a liability regime to deal with it, which is not dissimilar from the liability regime associated with acid gas disposal in connection with oil and gas production in the United States. We actually have liability regimes that deal with these kinds of underground injection regimes. This isn't rocket science. The question here is whether the amount of potential liability is so large that one might have to enact something on the carbon storage side, equivalent perhaps to the Price-Anderson Act, or to the other kinds of government insurance situations. Again, I think it is unlikely that we're looking at catastrophic releases, given the dispersed nature of the carbon dioxide storage and the fact that typically these storage sites are not sitting on top of populations, as was the case in Lake Nyos. So it's a complicated topic. There's some thinking out there. There are many ways to deal with this, all the way from requiring developers to produce private insurance to some sort of federal guarantee regime. Most of the people who are looking at this topic have sort of come to the conclusion that there needs to be, for some period of time, there needs to be some public-private sharing of liability.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I've been kind of wondering about is, you know, understanding that IGCC makes carbon storage far easier. I wondered why we haven't at least gone down the path of starting to try to show the capturing of combustion waste from maybe a combustion turbine combined cycle or something where it's already, you know, fairly close to the same type of emission stream. But I've been told that part of the reason that nobody's doing that is that they don't know what to do with the CO2 yet, or aren't quite sure, or don't want to have the liability if there's no cost for emitting the CO2 for free.
Are you talking about post-combustion capture? I'm sorry, you're
right. Post-combustion capture of the gases coming out of a combined cycle gas turbine
right.
should be at least somewhat analogous to capturing the gases coming out of a IGCC.
Yeah, actually, there's very little chemical relationship between the two things. They're not similar at all. the process by which CO2 is separated pre-combustion in an IGCC is quite different from what you would do post-combustion with CO2 coming out of a natural gas combined cycle. They're really not analogous processes at all.
Okay, is that because you do the gasification in a pure oxygen environment?
No, not necessarily. Although that is one of the ideas out there is a pure oxygen fueled actually combustion process. So that would actually be post combustion. No, the reason is simply that the results that due to the creation of the synthetic gas, you've already separated the nitrogen. Before you're putting it into the plant, the synthetic gas is already basically carbon dioxide. Well, it's basically CO and hydrogen, and through a water shift reaction prior to the combustion, you can hive off the CO2. That's a very different process. That is injecting water into a COH2 mixture and getting CO2. To separate out is a very different process than trying to separate CO2 from in a post-combustion framework like what comes out the back end of a combined cycle. And the difference is actually, Rod, much more has to do with the function or the way to do it. The lay way to describe this difference would be that the CO2 stream you get from a pre-combustion capture process is a much more concentrated stream than because you can do it chemically through a water shift reaction. You get a pure CO2 and very concentrated stream coming out, as opposed to post combustion capture where CO2 is mixed in with a bunch of other contaminants, and you're looking for those CO2 molecules amidst a variety of other combustion waste products. Okay. So they're quite different, and in fact, a good deal of research is going into the post-combustion side of the equation right now, though there don't appear to be any solutions right now that are as elegant as the water shift reaction as it's applied to pre-combustion capture in an IGCC.
Okay. Now, when you talk about the water shift reaction, does that mean that water is part of the inlet mix? Do you have to have coal and water going in?
No, the water is injected after the synthetic gas is created. The water is simply injected into the COH2 mixture. I'm not a chemist, but my understanding is that the what happens is you inject H2O into H2 plus CO, and what you get out the other end is H2 plus CO2.
Right, but so water is part of the fuel mix, I would say, I guess, for the IGCC?
No, the water doesn't go into the turbine. The water bonds with the carbon atoms and the oxygen atoms to produce a CO2 stream. The water is not part of the fuel mixture. The water is part of a exogenous cycle called a shift reaction cycle that's embedded prior to the combustion. So I don't think there's any way to characterize the water as fuel. You could characterize the water as something that assists the extraction of the carbon dioxide from the fuel. That would be technically a more precise way to describe it.
I'm no chemist either. I'm a nuke. Chemistry is not my strongest suit. But all right. Well, I've enjoyed the conversation, and I'm really encouraged by the fact that your organization is taking a harder look and talking with folks about nuclear, and one of the things I like to do is to open up a few people's minds by suggesting a few things about nuclear power that most people, even from the NEI, won't talk about much. And one of them is that nuclear plants don't have to be big. Obviously, we've been operating submarines for 50 years, which shows you that it's technically feasible to build smaller plants. And secondly, that, as you said, the storage of the waste is a fairly well-proven thing. We've been doing it for 50 years without hurting anyone. Certainly it's above ground, and it's not permanently disposed of, but it is well-handled. place that doesn't hurt anybody.
Yeah, Rod, I just have to interject. I didn't make any statement about nuclear waste on this show, to my knowledge, other than that it is a risk. The risks associated with it would have to be compared against the risks of other technologies. I didn't qualitatively characterize it as big or small or greater or lesser than any other risk. I mean, I'm not even sure I have an opinion on that, but I'd want to make clear that I didn't make a statement that the risks of nuclear waste disposal are, you know, X or Y. I made no such statement.
No, I understand. And like I said, I was just throwing out a few things to think about, not necessarily in response to anything in particular that you said, but certainly that is often said by people who are either neutral or opposed to nuclear power. You know, many times I call it some people's trump card. You know, they say, well, yeah, you can run it under submarine or you can produce electricity at 1.67 cents a kilowatt hour or whatever, but what do you do with the waste? And it's like they want to stop all conversation at that point. I just wanted to make the point that it's worth talking about, not something that should stop conversation.
Right.
You know, that's why I wanted to chat with you. I wanted to, you know.
No, I appreciate that. I thought that you said that I think at one point you said, as you said, and then you made a series of statements characterizing nuclear waste, and those are not things that I said.
Okay.
Keep the record straight.
That's good, because sometimes my record gets totally confused because I'm getting old.
No, it's a confusing area. It's a confusing area.
So can you tell me, your organization was formed in 96, and you're a Boston-based group. Who supports it? Why does it exist?
Well, it is supported by, first of all, our board of directors consists of individuals, and they're the governing body of the organization, of individuals who are both experts on environment as well as business people involved in the energy field and in the carbon regulation field. We are philanthropically supported. That is, we take no government money, we take no corporate money, and we take no individual money for the most part. Most of our funding comes from private foundations, philanthropic foundations, such as the Pew Charitable Trusts, the Joyce Foundation, and other philanthropies. So we're almost 100% foundation supported.
Okay. Fair enough. And I guess that should be about enough. Do you have anything else you'd like to share?
No, Rod, I enjoyed the chat. And as I said, I think that the nuclear question is one that's going to get a lot more interesting, not only for environmentalists, but for everyone, as we increasingly focus on the significant challenge associated with carbon dioxide and climate change. And I applaud your efforts to promote dialogue on that topic.
And thank you for showing up, for
okay.
coming in, and have a great evening.
You
Take
too.
Care.
Bye-bye now. So long.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.